The catapult fires. In the span of about 2 seconds, you go from 0 to around 165 miles per hour. Your body presses back into the seat at roughly 3 to 4 times the force of gravity. Your vision tunnels for a fraction of a second. Then you're airborne, climbing out over the water with your hands on the stick and your brain catching up to the rest of you. Now do that twice a day. Every day, for years. This is Radio Hangar. I'm Tower, and you're listening to ATIS. The United States House of Representatives Oversight Committee has released a report calling for a long-term study into whether repeated carrier aviation operations, including catapult launches, arrested landings, and high-G maneuvering, may be causing cumulative brain injuries in Navy pilots. That story is getting some attention in the defense press, but I think it deserves a longer look from everyone in this community. Not just because of what it means for military aviators, but because of what it might reveal about the relationship between flying and the human brain. Before we get into it, today's segment is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins built to mark the milestones, discipline, and pride behind every step in flight. From first solo to airline transport pilot, every coin tells a story. AviationSoul.com. Now, let's talk about what the catapult actually does to a human being. Steam catapults, which the Navy has used for decades on conventional carriers, accelerate an aircraft from a standstill to flying speed in roughly 2 seconds. The exact numbers vary by aircraft weight and wind over deck, but you're looking at forces in the range of 3 to 4 G during the shot. That means a pilot weighing 180 pounds is effectively experiencing a load of 540 to over 700 pounds pressing against their body in that moment. The newer electromagnetic aircraft launch system, EMALS, on ships like the USS Gerald R. Ford, is designed to provide a smoother, more controlled acceleration curve compared to the spike you get from steam. Whether that translates to meaningfully less physiological stress on pilots over time is actually one of the open questions this proposed study would try to answer. Now, catapult launches get a lot of the attention, but landing is arguably the more violent event. When a Navy pilot traps an arrested landing on a carrier deck, they go from approach speed, usually somewhere around 130 to 150 miles per hour depending on the aircraft, to 0 in about 2 seconds. The arresting wire absorbs that energy, but the pilot's body experiences that deceleration directly. The head continues forward relative to the spine. The brain, floating in cerebrospinal fluid inside the skull, experiences its own micro-movement relative to the cranial vault. It's not a dramatic impact. There is no helmet meeting the canopy, but the mechanics of rapid deceleration transmit force to the brain nonetheless in ways that researchers are only beginning to quantify at a career scale. Multiply that by the number of carrier landings called traps that a fleet aviator accumulates over a career. A typical carrier pilot might log somewhere between 1,000 and 1,500 traps over a 20-year career. Some more, some less. Every single one of those traps involves a rapid deceleration event. Every single one of those catapult shots involves a rapid acceleration event. And on top of that, you have the air combat maneuvering environment. Fighter and attack pilots routinely pull G-forces of 5, 6, 7, sometimes 9 times the force of gravity during training and operational sorties. Those sustained G-loads affect blood flow to the brain, require the pilot to strain hard against G-induced loss of consciousness using the anti-G straining maneuver, and put mechanical stress on the entire body, including the brain. The anti-G straining maneuver protects against GLOC, G-induced loss of consciousness in the moment. Whether it does anything to protect against the long-term effects of repeated exposure is a different and, as yet, unanswered question. Here's what you need to know about the research background. The House report does not claim that carrier pilots are being injured. It calls for a study to find out. That distinction matters. Right now, we do not have a definitive answer. What we do have is a pattern of concern that has been building in the medical and aerospace medicine communities for years, and an emerging body of research from other fields that suggests the question is worth asking seriously. The closest parallel most people will recognize is the research that transformed how we think about football. Chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE, was not something most people had heard of 20 years ago. Then researchers started examining the brains of former NFL players, and the findings were sobering. Repeated subconcussive impacts, hits that do not cause a diagnosed concussion, but that still transmit force to the brain, appeared to be associated with progressive neurological damage over time. The key word there is subconcussive. You do not have to be knocked out. You do not have to have a diagnosed concussion. The concern with carrier aviation is that repeated acceleration and deceleration events, even without a single dramatic injury event, might add up to something significant over a career. The mechanism proposed is similar. the brain moving inside the skull, tearing at the bridging vessels and axonal fibers that connected structures incrementally over hundreds and thousands of events. Researchers at institutions including the Naval Aerospace Medical Research Laboratory have been working on aspects of this problem for years. Aerospace medicine has long known that G-forces affect cognition in the short term. The question being raised now is about the long term. What happens to the brain of someone who has spent 20 years flying fighters off carrier decks? What happens to cognitive function, to memory, to mood, to judgment in the years after retirement? Are there markers of neurological change that we could detect and track if we were looking systematically? We do not have clean answers because we have not done the systematic longitudinal study required to get them. That is what the House Oversight Committee is asking the Department of Defense to do. A longitudinal study means following a population of subjects over an extended period of time. You establish baseline measurements early in a pilot's career, and then you track changes over years and decades. You look at cognitive function, neurological markers in blood, imaging studies as technology permits, and you compare that population to appropriate control groups. It is expensive, it takes time, and it requires institutional commitment that survives multiple budget cycles. But it is the only way to get real answers. The report calls for this kind of structured, long-term approach rather than the scattered, smaller-scale research that has characterized the field so far. Whether Congress will actually fund such a study and whether the Department of Defense will prioritize it are separate questions. The history of military medicine research on occupational health issues is complicated. Progress often moves slowly, and slowly is exactly the wrong pace when the question involves an accumulating exposure. But the fact that an oversight committee is formally calling for it represents a meaningful shift in how seriously this is being taken at the institutional level. Now, I want to connect this to something broader for the civilian aviation community listening right now. Most of us are never going to fly off a carrier. Most of us are never going to pull sustained 7G turns in a fleet fighter. But the physiological questions being raised here are not entirely irrelevant to general aviation. Think about the warbird community. Pilots who fly P-51s, Thunderbolts, Corsairs at air shows across the country perform aerobatic routines that involve multiple G-positive and G-negative loading cycles. Many of those performers accumulate significant G-exposures over careers that span decades. We do not have studies on what that does to the brain long-term. Think about aerobatic competition pilots. Extra 300s, Sukhoi 29s, competitors at the national and international level fly sequences involving sustained G loads and rapid transitions between positive and negative G. The unlimited category is about as physically demanding as civilian aviation gets. Think about agricultural pilots who spend entire careers in low-level maneuvering flight, pulling G at the end of every pass for years. The G forces are lower than a fighter, but the career exposure time is high. The military study, if it happens, will produce data about the mechanisms by which aviation operations affect the brain over time. That data will be relevant beyond the carrier deck. It might reshape how the aerospace medicine community thinks about medical standards for high-performance civilian aviation. It might inform how aviation medical examiners approach pilots in high-G operations. It might change what we understand about the relationship between sustained aerobatic flying and long-term cognitive health. If you fly high-performance aircraft of any kind, here's the practical bottom line for today. The current state of knowledge says that a single high G flight profile in the absence of a G-low event or diagnosed concussion is unlikely to cause lasting harm in an otherwise healthy pilot. That is the existing science. We are not at a point where the evidence says that flying an aerobatic sequence once or 10 times is a problem. The concern is cumulative. It is about careers, not individual flights. And that concern is precisely what the proposed study is designed to investigate in a rigorous, longitudinal way. If you accumulate significant G exposure in your flying, the most useful thing you can do right now is make sure your aviation medical examiner has a complete picture of your operation. Not because there is a diagnosis to worry about today, but because baseline cognitive function and neurological health data documented in your medical file early in your career becomes much more useful if questions arise 10 or 20 years from now. That record is yours. Build it. There is also an operational readiness dimension to this story that goes beyond individual health. The United States Navy spends enormous resources recruiting, selecting, and training carrier aviators. The pipeline from initial flight training to a fleet-ready carrier pilot takes years and costs millions of dollars per individual. If there is a long-term neurological effect from career carrier operations that subtly affects cognitive function or judgment in senior aviators, that is not only a health issue for those individuals, it is a readiness question for the institution. An aviator who is developing gradual cognitive changes from accumulated G exposure is not necessarily going to self-report that. The aeromedical system is only as good as the tests it applies and the data it has to work with. A longitudinal study creates the baseline data that makes better screening possible. It creates the evidence base for informed policy. The House committee framing this as an oversight issue is, I think, the right framing. This is exactly the kind of question oversight exists to ask. The people doing the flying deserve to know what the institution knows and what it does not know yet. I want to leave you with one thought. Aviation has always had a complicated relationship with the occupational health of the people who do it. The hypoxia issues that affected certain naval aircraft in recent years, generating unexplained physiological episodes in T-45 and F/A-18 pilots, took years of investigation. Altitude-related research took decades to fully translate into practical decompression protocols. The pattern is consistent. Pilots experience something, it takes time for the institution to formally acknowledge it, and longer still to study it rigorously. The House report on brain injuries in carrier pilots is asking us not to wait for that pattern to play out again. To get ahead of it, to do the study before we have a generation of retired naval aviators with unexplained neurological symptoms asking whether anyone was paying attention while they were flying. That seems like the right question to be asking. It took us too long to ask it about concussions in football. Let's not make the same mistake in aviation. My sources today include reporting from AeroTime and public information from the Naval Aerospace Medical Research Laboratory. More at radiohangar.com. I'm Tower.